Welcome to Prime Video's Culture-Rated Collection. This is the place where Black is the main character, where we don't jump through hoops just to hear our voice and can fall in love with illuminating documentaries like Giannis, The Marvelous Journey.
I'm just a hard worker that's trying to survive.
Enjoy the animated series, The Second Best Hospital in the Galaxy.
All doctors report immediately!
Where we dive into something new like the latest season of Them, The Scare, and the award-winning American Fiction.
Welcome home, baby!
Or add to the experience by buying or renting the biopic of a legend, Bob Marley, One Love.
I want my music to unify people.
And add on channels like Paramount Plus and Stars to bask in nostalgia with Beverly Hills Cop.
This is the cleanest police car I've ever been in my life.
And BMF.
You're about to take over the whole nation.
Explore Prime Video's Culture-Rated Collection and enjoy old school greats and new school hits. Prime Video. Find your happy place. Restrictions apply. See Amazon.com/AmazonPrime for details.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Section 15 of The Adventures of Gerard. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. How the Brigadier Rode to Minsk. Continued. He slipped out his knife, thrust the blade between the clenched teeth of the Russian, and turned it so as to force his mouth open. There on his tongue was the little wad of wet paper which he had been so anxious to swallow. Udan picked it out, and I let go of the man's throat. From the way in which, half-strangled as he was, he glanced at the paper, I was sure that it was a message of extreme importance. His hands twitched as if he longed to snatch it from me. He shrugged his shoulders, however, and smiled good-humouredly when I apologised for my roughness. "And now to business," said I, when he had done coughing and hawking. "What is your name?"
"Alexis Barakoff."
"Your rank and regiment?"
"Captain of the Dragoons of Grodno."
"What is this note which you were carrying?"
"It is a line which I had written to my sweetheart."
"Whose name," said I, examining the address, "is the Hetman Platov." "Come, come, sir, this is an important military document which you are carrying from one general to another. Tell me this instant what it is."
"Read it, and then you will know."
He spoke perfect French, as do most of the educated Russians. But he knew well that there is not one French officer in 1,000 who knows a word of Russian. The inside of the note contained one single line, which ran like this:
"Pudzhte Franzuzi pridut Minsk, min gotovi."
I stared at it, and I had to shake my head. Then I showed it to my hussars, but they could make nothing of it. The Poles were all rough fellows who could not read or write, save only the sergeant, who came from Memel in East Prussia, and knew no Russian. It was maddening, for I felt that I had possession of some important secret upon which the safety of the army might depend, and yet I could make no sense of it. Again I entreated our prisoner to translate it, and offered him his freedom if he would do so. He only smiled at my request. I could not but admire him, for it was the very smile which I should have myself smiled had I been in his position. "At least," said I, "tell us the name of this village."
"It is Duprova."
"And that is Minsk over yonder, I suppose?"
"Yes, that is Minsk."
"Then we shall go to the village, and we shall very soon find someone who will translate this dispatch." So we rode onward together, a trooper with his carbine unslung on either side of our prisoner. The village was but a little place, and I set a guard at the ends of the single street, so that no one could escape from it. It was necessary to call a halt and to find some food for the men and horses, since they had travelled all night and had a long journey still before them. There was one large stone house in the centre of the village, and to this I rode. It was the house of the priest, a snuffy and ill-favoured old man, who had not a civil answer to any of our questions. An uglier fellow I never met,
But my faith, it was very different with his only daughter who kept house for him. She was a brunette, a rare thing in Russia, with creamy skin, raven hair, and a pair of the most glorious dark eyes that ever kindled at the sight of a hussar. From the first glance I saw that she was mine. It was no time for love-making when a soldier's duty had to be done, but still, as I took the simple meal which they laid before me, I chatted lightly with the lady, and we were the best of friends before an hour had passed. Sophie was her first name, her second I never knew. I taught her to call me Etienne, and I tried to cheer her up, for her sweet face was sad, and there were tears in her beautiful dark eyes. I pressed her to tell me what it was which was grieving her. "How can I be otherwise?" said she, speaking French with a most adorable lisp. "When one of my poor countrymen is a prisoner in your hands. I saw him between two of your hussars as you rode into the village." "It is the fortune of war," said I. "His turn today, mine perhaps tomorrow." "But consider, monsieur," said she.
"Etienne," said I.
"Oh, monsieur."
"Etienne," said I.
"Well, then," she cried, beautifully flushed and desperate, "consider, Etienne, that this young officer will be taken back to your army and will be starved or frozen. For if, as I hear, your own soldiers have a hard march, what will be the lot of a prisoner?" I shrugged my shoulders. "You have a kind face, Etienne," said she. "You would not condemn this poor man to certain death. I entreat you to let him go." Her delicate hand rested upon my sleeve. Her dark eyes looked imploringly into mine. A sudden thought passed through my mind. I would grant her request, but I would demand a favour in return. At my order, the prisoner was brought up into the room. "Captain Barakoff," said I, "this young lady has begged me to release you, and I am inclined to do so. I would ask you to give your parole that you will remain in this dwelling for 24 hours and take no steps to inform anyone of our movements."
"I would do so," said he.
"Then I trust in your honour. One man, more or less, can make no difference in a struggle between great armies, and to take you back as a prisoner would be to condemn you to death. Depart, sir, and show your gratitude not to me, but to the first French officer who falls into your hands." When he was gone, I drew my paper from my pocket. "Now, Sophie," said I have done what you asked me, and all that I ask in return is that you will give me a lesson in Russian."
"With all my heart," said she.
"Let us begin on this," said I, spreading out the paper before her. "Let us take it word for word and see what it means."
"It means," said she, "if the French come to Minsk, all is lost."
Suddenly, a look of consternation passed over her beautiful face.
"Great heavens," she cried, "what is it that I have done? I have betrayed my country. Oh, Etienne, your eyes are the last for whom this message is meant. How could you be so cunning as to make a poor, simple-minded and unsuspecting girl betray the cause of her country?"
I consoled my poor Sophie as best I might, and I assured her that it was no reproach to her that she should be outwitted by so old a campaigner and so shrewd a man as myself. Higher they rose, and higher, until at last, as the sun sank toward the west, we were in the broad main street and galloped up it amid the shouts of the mujiks and the cries of frightened women until we found ourselves in front of the great town hall. My cavalry I drew up in the square, and I, with my two sergeants, Houdin and Papillette, rushed into the building. Heavens, shall I ever forget the sight which greeted us? Right in front of us was drawn up a triple line of Russian grenadiers. Their muskets rose as we entered, and a crashing volley burst into our very faces. Houdin and Papillette dropped upon the floor, riddled with bullets. For myself, my busby was shot away, and I had two holes through my dolman. The grenadiers ran at me with their bayonets. "Treason!" I cried. "We are betrayed! Stand to your horses!" I rushed out of the hall, but the whole square was swarming with troops. From every side street, dragoons and Cossacks were riding down upon us.
and such a rolling fire had burst from the surrounding houses that half my men and horses were on the ground. "Follow me," I yelled, and sprang upon Violette, but a giant of a Russian dragoon officer threw his arms round me, and we rolled on the ground together. He shortened his sword to kill me, but changing his mind, he seized me by the throat and banged my head against the stones until I was unconscious. So it was that I became the prisoner of the Russians. When I came to myself, my only regret was that my captor had not beaten out my brains. There in the grand square of Minsk lay half my troopers, dead or wounded, with exultant crowds of Russians gathered around them. The rest, in a melancholy group, were herded into the porch of the town hall, a sotnia of Cossacks keeping guard over them. Alas, what could I say? What could I do? It was evident that I had led my men into a carefully baited trap. They had heard of our mission, and they had prepared for us. And yet there was that dispatch which had caused me to neglect all precautions and to ride straight into the town. How was I to account for that? The tears ran down my cheeks as I surveyed the ruin of my squadron and as I thought of the plight of my comrades of the Grand Army, who awaited the food which I was to have brought them. Ney had trusted me, and I had failed him. How often he would strain his eyes over the snowfields for that convoy of grain which should never gladden his sight. My own fate was hard enough. An exile in Siberia was the best which the future could bring me. But you will believe me, my friends, it was not for his own sake, but for that of his starving comrades that Etienne Gerard's cheeks were lined by his tears, frozen even as they were shed. "What's this?" said a gruff voice at my elbow, and I turned to face the huge black-bearded dragoon who had dragged me from my saddle. "Look at the Frenchman crying. I thought that the Corsican was followed by brave men, not by children." "If you and I were face to face and alone, I should let you see which is the better man," said I. For answer, the brute struck me across the face with his open hand. I seized him by the throat, but a dozen of his soldiers tore me away from him, and he struck me again while they held my hands. "You base hound," I cried, "is this the way to treat an officer and a gentleman?"
"We never asked you to come to Russia," said he. "If you do, you must take such treatment as you can get. I would shoot you off hand if I had my way."
"You will answer for this some day," I cried, as I wiped the blood from my moustache.
"If the Hetman Platov is of my way of thinking, you will not be alive this time tomorrow," he answered with a ferocious scowl.
He added some words in Russian to his troops, and instantly they all sprang to their saddles. Poor Violette, looking as miserable as her master, was led round, and I was told to mount her. My left arm was tied with a thong, which was fastened to the stirrup iron of a sergeant of dragoons. So, in most sorry plight, I and the remnant of my men set forth from Minsk. Never have I met such a brute as this man Sergenei, who commanded the escort. The Russian army contains the best and the worst in the world, but a worse than Major Sergenei of the Dragoons of Kiev I have never seen in any force outside of the guerrillas of the peninsula. He was a man of great stature, with a fierce, hard face and a bristling black beard which fell over his cuirass. I have been told since that he was noted for his strength and his bravery, and I could answer for it that he had the grip of a bear, for I had felt it when he tore me from my saddle. He was a wit, too, in his way, and made continual remarks in Russian at our expense, which set all his dragoons and Cossacks laughing. Twice he beat my comrades with his riding whip, and once he approached me with the lash swung over his shoulder, but there was something in my eyes which prevented it from falling. So, in misery and humiliation, cold and starving, we rode in a disconsolate column across the vast snow plain. The sun had sunk, but still in the long northern twilight we pursued our weary journey. Numbed and frozen, with my head aching from the blows it had received, I was borne onward by Violette, hardly conscious of where I was or whither I was going. The little mare walked with a sunken head,
only raising it to snort her contempt for the mangy Cossack ponies who were around her. But suddenly the escort stopped, and I found that we had halted in the single street of a small Russian village. There was a church on one side, and on the other was a large stone house, the outline of which seemed to me to be familiar. I looked around me in the twilight, and then I saw that we had been led back to Dobrova, and that this house, at the door of which we were waiting, was the same house of the priest at which we had stopped in the morning. Here it was that my charming Sophie, in her innocence, had translated the unlucky message which had in some strange way led us to our ruin. To think that only a few hours before we had left this very spot with such high hopes and all fair prospects for our mission, and now the remnants of us waited as beaten and humiliated men for whatever lot a brutal enemy might ordain. But such is the fate of the soldier, my friends. Kisses today, blows tomorrow. Tokay in a palace, ditch water in a hovel. Furs or rags, a full purse or an empty pocket, ever swaying from the best to the worst, with only his courage and his honour unchanging. End of section 15. Section 16 of The Adventures of Gerard. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. How the Brigadier Rode to Minsk. Continued. The Russian horsemen dismounted, and my poor fellows were ordered to do the same. It was already late, and it was clearly their intention to spend the night in this village. There were great cheering and joy amongst the peasants when they understood that we had all been taken, and they flocked out of their houses with flaming torches, the women carrying out tea and brandy for the Cossacks. Amongst others, the old priest came forth, the same whom we had seen in the morning. He was all smiles now, and he bore with him some hot punch on a salver, the reek of which I can remember still. Behind her father was Sophie. With horror I saw her clasp Major Sergine's hand as she congratulated him upon the victory he had won and the prisoners he had made. The old priest, her father, looked at me with an insolent face and made insulting remarks at my expense, pointing at me with his lean and grimy hand. His fair daughter Sophie looked at me also, but she said nothing, and I could read her tender pity in her dark eyes. At last she turned to Major Sergine and said something to him in Russian, on which he frowned and shook his head impatiently. She appeared to plead with him, standing there in the flood of light which shone from the open door of her father's house. My eyes were fixed upon the two faces, that of the beautiful girl and of the dark, fierce man, for my instinct told me that it was my own fate which was under debate. For a long time the soldier shook his head, and then, at last softening before her pleadings, he appeared to give way. He turned to where I stood with my guardian sergeant beside me.
"These good people offer you the shelter of their roof for the night," said he to me, looking me up and down with vindictive eyes. "I find it hard to refuse them, but I tell you straight that for my part I had rather see you on the snow. It would cool your hot blood, you rascal of a Frenchman." I looked at him with the contempt that I felt. "You were born a savage and you will die one," said I. My words stung him, for he broke into an oath, raising his whip as if he would strike me.
"Silence, you crop-eared dog," he cried. "Had I my way, some of the insolence would be frozen out of you before morning."
Mastering his passion, he turned upon Sophie with what he meant to be a gallant manner.
"If you have a cellar with a good lock," said he, "the fellow may lie in it for the night. Since you have done him the honour to take an interest in his comfort, I must have his parole that he will not attempt to play us any tricks, as I am answerable for him until I hand him over to the Hetman Platov tomorrow."
His supercilious manner was more than I could endure. He had evidently spoken French to the lady in order that I might understand the humiliating way in which he referred to me. "I will take no favour from you," said I. "You may do what you like, but I will never give you my parole." The Russian shrugged his great shoulders and turned away as if the matter were ended.
"Very well, my fine fellow. So much the worse for your fingers and toes.
"'We shall see how you are in the morning after a night in the snow.'
"'One moment, Major Sergine,' cried Sophie. "'You must not be so hard upon this prisoner. "'There are some special reasons why he has a claim upon our kindness and mercy.'
"'The Russian looked with suspicion upon his face from her to me. "'What are the special reasons? "'You certainly seem to take a remarkable interest in this Frenchman,' said he.
"'The chief reason is that he has this very morning, of his own accord, "'released Captain Alexis Barakoff of the Dragoons of Grodno.'
"'It is true,' said Barakoff, who had come out of the house. "'He captured me this morning, and he released me upon parole "'rather than take me back to the French army, where I should have been starved.'
"'Since Colonel Gerard has acted so generously, "'you will surely, now that fortune has changed, "'allow us to offer him the poor shelter of our cellar upon this bitter night,' said Sophie. "'It is a small return for his generosity.'
But the dragoon was still in the sulks.
"'Let him give me his parole first, that he will not attempt to escape,' said he. "'Do you hear, sir? Do you give me your parole?'
"'I give you nothing,' said I.
"'Colonel Gerard,' cried Sophie, turning to me with a coaxing smile, "'you will give me your parole, will you not?'
"'To you, mademoiselle, I can refuse nothing. "'I will give you my parole with pleasure.'
"'There, Major Sergine,' cried Sophie in triumph. "'That is surely sufficient. "'You have heard him say that he gives me his parole. "'I will be answerable for his safety.'
"'In an ungracious fashion, my Russian bear grunted his consent, "'and so I was led into the house, "'followed by the scowling father and by the big black-bearded dragoon.' In the basement there was a large and roomy chamber where the winter logs were stored. Thither it was that I was led, and I was given to understand that this was to be my lodging for the night. One side of this bleak apartment was heaped up to the ceiling with fagots of firewood. The rest of the room was stone-flagged and bare-walled, with a single deep-set window upon one side, which was safely guarded with iron bars. For light I had a large stable lantern, which swung from a beam of the low ceiling. Major Sergine smiled as he took this down and swung it round so as to throw its light into every corner of that dreary chamber.
"'How do you like our Russian hotels, monsieur?'
he asked with his hateful sneer.
"'They are not very grand, but they are the best that we can give you. Perhaps the next time that you Frenchmen take a fancy to travel, you will choose some other country where they will make you more comfortable.'
He stood laughing at me, his white teeth gleaming through his beard. Then he left me, and I heard the great key creak in the lock. For an hour of utter misery, chilled in body and soul, I sat upon a pile of fagots, my face sunk upon my hands, and my mind full of the saddest thoughts. It was cold enough within those four walls, but I thought of the sufferings of my poor troopers outside, and I sorrowed with their sorrow. Then I paced up and down, and I clapped my hands together and kicked my feet against the walls to keep them from being frozen. The lamp gave out some warmth, but still it was bitterly cold, and I had had no food since morning. It seemed to me that everyone had forgotten me, but at last I heard the key turn in the lock, and who should enter but my prisoner of the morning, Captain Alexis Barakoff, a bottle of wine projected from under his arm, and he carried a great plate of hot stew in front of him. "'Hush!' said he. "'Not a word. Keep up your heart. I cannot stop to explain, for Sergine is still with us. Keep awake and ready.' With these hurried words, he laid down the welcome food and ran out of the room. "'Keep awake and ready!' The words rang in my ears. I ate my food and I drank my wine, but it was neither food nor wine which had warmed the heart within me. What could those words of Barakoff mean? Why was I to remain awake? For what was I to be ready? Was it possible that there was a chance yet of escape? I have never respected the man who neglects his prayers at all other times, and yet prays when he is in peril. It is like a bad soldier who pays no respect to the colonel, save when he would demand a favour of him. And yet, when I thought of the salt mines of Siberia on the one side,
and of my mother in France upon the other, I could not help a prayer rising, not from my lips, but from my heart, that the words of Barakoff might mean all that I hoped. But hour after hour struck upon the village clock, and still I heard nothing save the call of the Russian sentries in the street outside. Then at last my heart leaped within me, for I heard a light step in the passage. An instant later the key turned, the door opened, and Sophie was in the room. "Monsieur," she cried. "Etienne," said I. "Nothing will change you," said she. "But is it possible that you do not hate me? Have you forgiven me the trick which I played you?" "What trick?" I asked. "Good heavens, is it possible that even now you have not understood it? You have asked me to translate the dispatch. I have told you that it meant, if the French come to Minsk, all is lost." "What did it mean, then?" "It means, let the French come to Minsk, we are awaiting them." I sprang back from her. "You betrayed me," I cried. "You lured me into this trap. It is to you that I owe the death and capture of my men. Fool that I was to trust a woman."
"Do not be unjust, Colonel Gerard. I am a Russian woman, and my first duty is to my country. Would you not wish a French girl to have acted as I have done? Had I translated the message correctly, you would not have gone to Minsk, and your squadron would have escaped. Tell me that you forgive me."
She looked bewitching as she stood, pleading her cause in front of me. And yet, as I thought of my dead men, I could not take the hand which she held out to me.
"Very good," said she, as she dropped it by her side. "You feel for your own people, and I feel for mine, and so we are equal. But you have said one wise and kindly thing within these walls, Colonel Gerard. You have said one man, more or less, can make no difference in a struggle between two great armies. Your lesson of nobility is not wasted. Behind those fagots is an unguarded door. Here is the key to it. Go forth, Colonel Gerard, and I trust that we may never look upon each other's faces again."
I stood for an instant with the key in my hand and my head in a whirl. Then I handed it back to her. "I cannot do it," I said.
"Why not?"
"I have given my parole."
"To whom?" she asked.
"Why, to you."
"And I release you from it."
My heart bounded with joy. Of course, it was true what she said. I had refused to give my parole to Sergenay. I owed him no duty. If she relieved me from my promise, my honour was clear. I took the key from her hand.
"You will find Captain Barakoff at the end of the village street," said she. "We of the North never forget either an injury or a kindness. He has your mare and your sword waiting for you. Do not delay an instant, for in 2 hours it will be dawn."
So I passed out into the starlit Russian night and had that last glimpse of Sophie as she peered after me through the open door. She looked wistfully at me as if she expected something more than the cold thanks which I gave her. But even the humblest man has his pride, and I will not deny that mine was hurt by the deception which she had played upon me. I could not have brought myself to kiss her hand, far less her lips. The door led into a narrow alley, and at the end of it stood a muffled figure who held Violette by the bridle. "You told me to be kind to the next French officer whom I found in distress," said he. "Good luck, bon voyage," he whispered, as I bounded into the saddle. "Remember, Poltava is the watchword." It was well that he had given it to me, for twice I had to pass Cossack pickets before I was clear of the lines. I had just ridden past the last vedettes, and hoped that I was a free man again, when there was a soft thudding in the snow behind me, and a heavy man upon a great black horse came swiftly after me. My first impulse was to put spurs to Violette. My second, as I saw a long black beard against a steel cuirass, was to halt and await him.
"I thought it was you, you dog of a Frenchman," he cried, shaking his drawn sword at me. "So you have broken your parole, you rascal."
"I gave no parole."
"You lie, you hound."
I looked around and no one was coming. The vedettes were motionless and distant. We were all alone with the moon above and the snow beneath. Fortune has ever been my friend. "I gave you no parole."
"You gave it to the lady."
"Then I will answer for it to the lady."
"That would suit you better, no doubt. But unfortunately, you will have to answer for it to me."
"I am ready."
"Your sword, too. There is treason in this. I see it all. The woman has helped you. She shall see Siberia for this night's work."
The words were his death warrant. For Sophie's sake, I could not let him go back alive. Our blades crossed, and an instant later mine was through his black beard and deep in his throat. I was on the ground almost as soon as he, but the one thrust was enough. He died, snapping his teeth at my ankles like a savage wolf. 2 days later, I had rejoined the army at Smolensk and was a part once more of that dreary procession which tramped onward through the snow, leaving a long wheel of blood to show the path which it had taken. Enough, my friends. I would not reawaken the memory of those days of misery and death. They still come to haunt me in my dreams. When we halted at last in Warsaw, we had left behind us our guns, our transport, and 3/4 of our comrades. But we did not leave behind us the honour of Etienne Gerard. They have said that I broke my parole. Let them beware how they say it to my face, for the story is as I tell it, and old as I am, my forefinger is not too weak to press a trigger when my honour is in question. End of section 16, and end of How the Brigadier Rode to Minsk. Section 17 of The Adventures of Gerard. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. How the Brigadier Bore Himself at Waterloo. The Story of the Forest Inn. Of all the great battles in which I had the honour of drawing my sword for the Emperor and for France, there was not one which was lost. At Waterloo, although in a sense I was present, I was unable to fight, and the enemy was victorious. It is not for me to say that there is a connection between these two things. You know me too well, my friends, to imagine that I would make such a claim. But it gives matter for thought, and some have drawn flattering conclusions from it. After all, it was only a matter of breaking a few English squares, and the day would have been our own. If the Hussars of Conflans, with Etienne Gerard to lead them, could not do this, then the best judges are mistaken. But let that pass. The fates had ordained that I should hold my hand, and that the Emperor should fall. But they had also ordained that this day of gloom and sorrow should bring such honour to me as had never come when I swept on the wings of victory from Boulogne to Vienna. Never had I burned so brilliantly as at that supreme moment when the darkness fell upon all around me. You are aware that I was faithful to the Emperor in his adversity, and that I refused to sell my sword and my honour to the Bourbons. Never again was I to feel my war-horse between my knees, never again to hear the kettle-drums and silver trumpets behind me as I rode in front of my little rascals. But it comforts my heart, my friends, and it brings the tears to my eyes to think how great I was upon that last day of my soldier life, and to remember that of all the remarkable exploits which have won me the love of so many beautiful women and the respect of so many noble men, that there was none which, in splendour, in audacity, and in the great end which was attained, could compare with my famous ride upon the night of June 18th, 1815. I am aware that the story is often told at mess tables and in barrack rooms, so that there are few in the army who have not heard it, but modesty has sealed my lips until now, my friends. In the privacy of these intimate gatherings, I am inclined to lay the true facts before you. In the first place, there is one thing which I can assure you. In all his career, Napoleon never had so splendid an army as that with which he took the field for that campaign. In 1813, France was exhausted. For every veteran, there were 5 children, Marie-Louises, as we called them, for the Empress had busied herself in raising levies while the Emperor took the field. But it was very different in 1815. The prisoners had all come back, the men from the snows of Russia,
the men from the dungeons of Spain, the men from the hulks in England. These were the dangerous men, veterans of 20 battles, longing for their old trade and with hearts filled with hatred and revenge. The ranks were full of soldiers who wore 2 and 3 chevrons, every chevron meaning 5 years' service. And the spirit of these men was terrible. They were raging, furious, fanatical, adoring the emperor as a Mamluk does his prophet, ready to fall upon their own bayonets if their blood could serve him. If you had seen these fierce old veterans going into battle with their flushed faces, their savage eyes, their furious yells, you would wonder that anything could stand against them. So high was the spirit of France at that time that every other spirit would have quailed before it. But these people, these English, had neither spirit nor soul, but only solid, immovable beef, against which we broke ourselves in vain. That was it, my friends. On the one side, poetry, gallantry, self-sacrifice, all that is beautiful and heroic. On the other side, beef. Our hopes, our ideals, our dreams, all were shattered on that terrible beef of old England. You have read how the Emperor gathered his forces, and then how he and I, with 130,000 veterans, hurried to the northern frontier and fell upon the Prussians and the English. On the 16th of June, Ney held the English in play at Quatre Bras, while we beat the Prussians at Lagny. It is not for me to say how far I contributed to that victory, but it is well known that the Hussars of Conflans covered themselves with glory. They fought well, these Prussians, and 8,000 of them were left upon the field. The Emperor thought that he had done with them, as he sent Marshal Grouche with 32,000 men to follow them up and to prevent their interfering with his plans. Then, with nearly 80,000 men, he turned upon those goddamn Englishmen. How much we had to avenge upon them, we Frenchmen, the guineas of Pitt, the hulks of Portsmouth, the invasion of Wellington, the perfidious victories of Nelson. At last the day of punishment seemed to have arisen. Wellington had with him 67,000 men, but many of them were known to be Dutch and Belgian, who had no great desire to fight against us. Of good troops he had not 50,000. Finding himself in the presence of the Emperor in person with 80,000 men, this Englishman was so paralysed with fear that he could neither move himself nor his army. You have seen the rabbit when the snake approaches. So stood the English upon the ridge of Waterloo. The night before, the Emperor, who had lost an aide-de-camp at Lagny, ordered me to join his staff, and I had left my hussars to the charge of Major Victor. I know not which of us was the most grieved, they or I, that I should be called away upon the eve of battle, but an order is an order, and a good soldier can but shrug his shoulders and obey. With the Emperor, I rode across the front of the enemy's position on the morning of the 18th. He looking at them through his glass and planning which was the shortest way to destroy them. Saul was at his elbow, and Ney and Foy, and others who had fought the English in Portugal and Spain. "Have a care, sire," said Saul. "The English infantry is very solid." "You think them good soldiers because they have beaten you," said the Emperor, and we younger men turned away our faces and smiled. But Ney and Foy were grave and serious. All the time the English line, checkered with red and blue and dotted with batteries, was drawn up silent and watchful within a long musket shot of us. On the other side of the shallow valley, our own people, having finished their soup, were assembling for the battle. It had rained very heavily, but at this moment the sun shone out and beat upon the French army, turning our brigades of cavalry into so many dazzling rivers of steel, and twinkling and sparkling on the innumerable bayonets of the infantry. At the sight of that splendid army, and the beauty and majesty of its appearance, I could contain myself no longer, but rising in my stirrups, I waved my busby and cried, "Vive l'Empereur!" A shout which growled and roared and clattered from one end of the line to the other, while the horsemen waved their swords and the footmen held up their shakos upon their bayonets.
The English remained petrified upon their ridge. They knew that their hour had come. And so it would have come, if at that moment the word had been given and the whole army had been permitted to advance. We had but to fall upon them and to sweep them from the face of the earth. To put aside all question of courage, we were the more numerous, the older soldiers, and the better led. But the Emperor desired to do all things in order, and he waited until the ground should be drier and harder, so that his artillery could manoeuvre. So 3 hours were wasted, and it was 11 o'clock before we saw Jerome Bonaparte's columns advance upon our left, and heard the crash of the guns, which told that the battle had begun. The loss of those 3 hours was our destruction. The attack upon the left was directed upon a farmhouse which was held by the English guards, and we heard the 3 loud shouts of apprehension which the defenders were compelled to utter. They were still holding out, and d'Erlon's corps was advancing upon the right to engage another portion of the English line, when our attention was called away from the battle beneath our noses to a distant portion of the field of action. The Emperor had been looking through his glass to the extreme left of the English line, and now he turned suddenly to the Duke of Dalmatia, or Soult, as we soldiers preferred to call him. "What is it, Marshal?" said he. We all followed the direction of his gaze, some raising our glasses, some shading our eyes. There was a thick wood over yonder, then a long bare slope, and another wood beyond. Over this bare strip, between the two woods, there lay something dark, like the shadow of a moving cloud. "I think that they are cattle, sire," said Soult. At that instant there came a quick twinkle from amid the dark shadow. "It is Grouchy," said the Emperor, and he lowered his glass. "They are doubly lost, these English. I hold them in the hollow of my hand. They cannot escape me." He looked round, and his eyes fell upon me. "Ah, here is the Prince of Messengers," said he. "Are you well mounted, Colonel Gerard?" "I was riding my little Violette, the pride of the brigade. I said so." "Then ride hard to Marshal Grouchy, whose troops you see over yonder. Tell him that he is to fall upon the left flank and rear of the English, while I attack them in front. Together we should crush them, and not a man escape." I saluted and rode off without a word, my heart dancing with joy that such a mission should be mine. I looked at that long, solid line of red and blue, looming through the smoke of the guns, and I shook my fist at it as I went. "We shall crush them, and not a man escape." They were the Emperor's words, and it was I, Etienne Gerard, who was to turn them into deeds. I burned to reach the Marshal, and for an instant I thought of riding through the English left wing, as being the shortest cut. I have done bolder deeds and come out safely, but I reflected that if things went badly with me and I was taken or shot, the message would be lost and the plans of the Emperor miscarry. I passed in front of the cavalry, therefore, past the chasseurs, the lancers of the guard, the carabineers, the horse grenadiers, and lastly my own little rascals, who followed me wistfully with their eyes. Beyond the cavalry, the old guard was standing, 12 regiments of them, all veterans of many battles, sombre and severe, in long blue overcoats and high bearskins from which the plumes had been removed. Each bore within the goatskin knapsack upon his back the blue and white parade uniform which they would use for their entry into Brussels next day. As I rode past them, I reflected that these men had never been beaten, and as I looked at their weather-beaten faces and their stern and silent bearing, I said to myself that they never would be beaten. Great heavens, how little could I foresee what a few more hours would bring! On the right of the old guard were the young guard and the 6th Corps of Lobau, and then I passed Jacquinot's lancers and Marbot's hussars, who held the extreme flank of the line. All these troops knew nothing of the corps which was coming toward them through the wood, and their attention was taken up in watching the battle which raged upon their left. More than 100 guns were thundering from each side, and the din was so great that of all the battles which I have fought, I cannot recall more than half a dozen which were as noisy. I looked back over my shoulder, and there were two brigades of cuirassiers, English and French, pouring down the hill together, with the sword blades playing over them like summer lightning. How I longed to turn Violette and to lead my hussars into the thick of it. What a picture! Etienne Gerard with his back to the battle and a fine cavalry action raging behind him. But duty is duty, so I rode past Marbot's vedettes and on in the direction of the wood, passing the village of Frishamon upon my left. In front of me lay the great wood, called the Wood of Paris, consisting mostly of oak trees, with a few narrow paths leading through it. I halted and listened when I reached it, but out of its gloomy depths there came no blare of trumpet, no murmur of wheels, no tramp of horses to mark the advance of that great column which, with my own eyes, I had seen streaming toward it. The battle roared behind me, but in front all was as silent as that grave in which so many brave men would shortly sleep. The sunlight was cut off by the arches of leaves above my head, and a heavy, damp smell rose from the sodden ground. For several miles I galloped at such a pace as few riders would care to go, with roots below and branches above. Then, at last, for the first time, I caught a glimpse of Grouchy's advance guard. Scattered parties of hussars passed me on either side, but some distance off among the trees. I heard the beating of a drum far away, and the low, dull murmur which an army makes upon the march. Any moment I might come upon the staff and deliver my message to Grouchy in person, for I knew well that on such a march a marshal of France would certainly ride with the van of his army. Suddenly the trees thinned in front of me, and I understood with delight that I was coming to the end of the wood, whence I could see the army and find the marshal. End of section 17. Section 18 of The Adventures of Gerard. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. How the Brigadier Bore Himself at Waterloo. The Story of the Forest Inn. Continued. Where the track comes out from amid the trees, there is a small cabaret where woodcutters and wagoners drink their wine. Outside the door of this, I reined up my horse for an instant while I took in the scene which was before me. Some few miles away I saw a second great forest, that of St. Lambert, out of which the Emperor had seen the troops advancing. It was easy to see, however, why there had been so long a delay in their leaving one wood and reaching the other, because between the two ran the deep defile of the Lannay, which had to be crossed. Sure enough, a long column of troops, horse, foot and guns, was streaming down one side of it and swarming up the other, while the advance guard was already among the trees on either side of me. A battery of horse artillery was coming along the road, and I was about to gallop up to it and ask the officer in command if he could tell me where I should find the marshal, when suddenly I observed that, though the gunners were dressed in blue, they had not the dolman trimmed with red Brandenburgs, as our own horse gunners wear it. Amazed at the sight, I was looking at these soldiers to left and right, when a hand touched my thigh, and there was the landlord, who had rushed from his inn.
"Madman!" he cried. "Why are you here? What are you doing?"
"I am seeking Marshal Grouchy."
"You are in the heart of the Prussian army. Turn and fly!"
"Impossible! This is Grouchy's corpse."
"How do you know?"
"Because the Emperor has said it."
"Then the Emperor has made a terrible mistake. I tell you that a patrol of Silesian hussars has this instant left me. Did you not see them in the wood?"
"I saw hussars."
"They are the enemy."
"Where is Grouchy?"
"He is behind. They have passed him."
"Then how can I go back? If I go forward, I may see him yet. I must obey my orders and find him, wherever he is." The man reflected for an instant.
"Quick, quick," he cried, seizing my bridle. "Do what I say, and you may yet escape. They have not observed you yet. Come with me, and I will hide you until they pass."
Behind his house there was a low stable, and into this he thrust Violette. Then he half led and half dragged me into the kitchen of the inn. It was a bare, brick-floored room. A stout, red-faced woman was cooking cutlets at the fire. "What's the matter now?" she asked, looking with a frown from me to the innkeeper. "Who is this you've brought in?"
"It is a French officer, Marie. We cannot let the Prussians take him."
"Why not?"
"Why not? Sacred name of a dog! Was I not myself a soldier of Napoleon? Did I not win a musket of honour among the Violettes of Guard? Shall I see a comrade taken before my eyes? Marie, we must save him."
But the lady looked at me with most unfriendly eyes.
"Pierre Charras," she said, "you will not rest until you have your house burned over your head. Do you not understand, you blockhead, that if you fought for Napoleon, it was because Napoleon ruled Belgium? He does so no longer. The Prussians are our allies, and this is our enemy. I will have no Frenchman in this house. Give him up."
The innkeeper scratched his head and looked at me in despair, but it was very evident to me that it was neither for France nor for Belgium that this woman cared, but that it was the safety of her own house that was nearest her heart. "Madame," said I, with all the dignity and assurance I could command, "the Emperor is defeating the English, and the French army will be here before evening. If you have used me well, you will be rewarded. And if you have denounced me, you will be punished, and your house will certainly be burned by the Provost Marshal." She was shaken by this, and I hastened to complete my victory by other methods. "Surely," said I, "it is impossible that anyone so beautiful can also be hard-hearted. You will not refuse me the refuge which I need?" She looked at my whiskers, and I saw that she was softened. I took her hand, and in 2 minutes we were on such terms that her husband swore roundly that he would give me up himself if I pressed the matter farther.
"Besides, the road is full of Prussians," he cried. "Quick, quick, into the loft!"
"Quick, quick, into the loft!" echoed his wife, and together they hurried me toward a ladder which led to a trap-door in the ceiling. There was loud knocking at the door, so you can think that it was not long before my spurs went twinkling through the hole and the board was dropped behind me. An instant later I heard the voices of the Germans in the rooms below me. The place in which I found myself was a single long attic, the ceiling of which was formed by the roof of the house. It ran over the whole of one side of the inn, and through the cracks in the flooring I could look down either upon the kitchen, the sitting-room, or the bar, at my pleasure. There were no windows, but the place was in the last stage of disrepair, and several missing slates upon the roof gave me light and the means of observation. The place was heaped with lumber fodder at one end and a huge pile of empty bottles at the other. There was no door or window, save the hole through which I had come up. I sat upon the heap of hay for a few minutes to steady myself and to think out my plans. It was very serious that the Prussians should arrive upon the field of battle earlier than our reserves. But there appeared to be only one corpse of them, and a corpse more or less makes little difference to such a man as the Emperor. He could afford to give the English all this and beat them still. The best way in which I could serve him, since Grouchy was behind, was to wait here until they were past, and then to resume my journey, to see the Marshal, and to give him his orders. If he advanced upon the rear of the English, instead of following the Prussians, all would be well. The fate of France depended upon my judgment and my nerve. It was not the first time, my friends, as you are well aware, and you know the reasons that I had to trust that neither nerve nor judgment would ever fail me. Certainly the Emperor had chosen the right man for his mission. The Prince of Messengers, he had called me. I would earn my title. It was clear that I could do nothing until the Prussians had passed, so I spent my time in observing them. I have no love for these people, but I am compelled to say that they kept excellent discipline, for not a man of them entered the inn, though their lips were caked with dust, and they were ready to drop with fatigue. Those who had knocked at the door were bearing an insensible comrade, and having left him, they returned at once to the ranks. Several others were carried in the same fashion, and laid in the kitchen, while a young surgeon, little more than a boy, remained behind in charge of them. Having observed them through the cracks in the floor, I next turned my attention to the holes in the roof, from which I had an excellent view of all that was passing outside. The Prussian corps was still streaming past. It was easy to see that they had made a terrible march and had little food, for the faces of the men were ghastly, and they were plastered from head to foot with mud from their falls upon the foul and slippery roads. Yet, spent as they were, their spirit was excellent, and they pushed and hauled at the gun carriages when the wheels sank up to the axles in the mire, and the weary horses were floundering knee-deep, unable to draw them through. The officers rode up and down the column, encouraging the more active with words of praise and the laggards with blows from the flat of their swords. All the time, from over the wood in front of them, there came the tremendous roar of the battle, as if all the rivers on earth had united in one gigantic cataract, booming and crashing in a mighty fall. Like the spray of the cataract was the long veil of smoke which rose high over the trees. The officers pointed to it with their swords, and with hoarse cries from their parched lips, the mud-stained men pushed onward to the battle. For an hour I watched them pass, and I reflected that their vanguard must have come into touch with Marbot's vedettes, and that the Emperor knew already of their coming. "You are going very fast up the road, my friends, but you will come down it a great deal faster," said I to myself, and I consoled myself with the thought. But an adventure came to break the monotony of this long wait. I was seated beside my loophole and congratulating myself that the corps was nearly past and that the road would soon be clear for my journey, when suddenly I heard a loud altercation break out in French in the kitchen. "You shall not go," cried a woman's voice. "I tell you that I will," said a man's, and there was a sound of scuffling. In an instant I had my eye to the crack in the floor. There was my stout lady, like a faithful watchdog, at the bottom of the ladder, while the young German surgeon, white with anger, was endeavouring to come up it. Several of the German soldiers who had recovered from their prostration were sitting about on the kitchen floor and watching the quarrel with stolid but attentive faces. The landlord was nowhere to be seen. "There is no liquor there," said the woman. "I do not want liquor. I want hay or straw for these men to lie upon. Why should they lie on the bricks when there is straw overhead?" "There is no straw." "What is up there?"
"Empty bottles."
"Nothing else?"
"No."
For a moment it looked as if the surgeon would abandon his intention, but one of the soldiers pointed up to the ceiling. I gathered from what I could understand of his words that he could see the straw sticking out between the planks. In vain the woman protested. Two of the soldiers were able to get upon their feet and to drag her aside, while the young surgeon ran up the ladder, pushed open the trap-door, and climbed into the loft. As he swung the door back, I slipped behind it, but as luck would have it, he shut it again behind him, and there we were left standing, face to face. Never have I seen a more astonished young man.
"A French officer!" he gasped.
"Hush!" said I. "Hush! Not a word above a whisper." I had drawn my sword.
"I am not a combatant," he said. "I am a doctor. Why do you threaten me with your sword? I am not armed."
"I do not wish to hurt you, but I must protect myself. I am in hiding here."
"A spy?"
"A spy does not wear such a uniform as this, nor do you find spies on the staff of an army." "I rode by mistake into the heart of this Prussian corps, and I concealed myself here in the hope of escaping when they are past. I will not hurt you if you do not hurt me. But if you do not swear that you will be silent as to my presence, you will never go down alive from this attic."
"You can put up your sword, sir," said the surgeon, and I saw a friendly twinkle in his eyes. "I am a Pole by birth, and I have no ill feeling to you or your people. I will do my best for my patients, but I will do no more. Capturing hussars is not one of the duties of a surgeon. With your permission, I will now descend with this truss of hay to make a couch for these poor fellows below."
I had intended to exact an oath from him, but it is my experience that if a man will not speak the truth, he will not swear the truth, so I said no more. The surgeon opened the trap-door, threw out enough hay for his purpose, and then descended the ladder, letting down the door behind him. I watched him anxiously when he rejoined his patients, and so did my good friend the landlady. But he said nothing and busied himself with the needs of his soldiers. By this time I was sure that the last of the army corps was past, and I went to my loophole, confident that I should find the coast clear, save perhaps for a few stragglers whom I could disregard. The first corps was indeed past, and I could see the last files of the infantry disappearing into the wood. But you can imagine my disappointment when out of the forest of St. Lambert I saw a second corps emerging as numerous as the first. There could be no doubt that the whole Prussian army, which we thought we had destroyed at Lagny, was about to throw itself upon our right wing, while Marshal Grouchy had been coaxed away upon some fool's errand. The roar of guns, much nearer than before, told me that the Prussian batteries which had passed me were already in action. Imagine my terrible position. Hour after hour was passing, the sun was sinking toward the west. And yet this cursed inn in which I lay hid was like a little island amid a rushing stream of furious Prussians. It was all important I should reach Marshal Grouchy, and yet I could not show my nose without being made prisoner. You can think how I cursed and tore my hair. How little do we know what is in store for us. Even while I raged against my ill fortune, that same fortune was reserving me for a far higher task than to carry a message to Grouchy. A task which could not have been mine had I not been held tight in that little inn on the edge of the forest of Paris. Two Russian corps had passed, and a third was coming up, when I heard a great fuss and the sound of several voices in the sitting room. By altering my position, I was able to look down and see what was going on. End of section 18.
Section 19 of The Adventures of Gerard. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. How the Brigadier bore himself at Waterloo. The Story of the Forest Inn. Continued. Two Prussian generals were beneath me, their heads bent over a map which lay upon the table. Several aides-de-camp and staff officers stood round in silence. Of the two generals, one was a fierce old man, white-haired and wrinkled, with a ragged, grizzled moustache and a voice like the bark of a hound. The other was younger, but long-faced and solemn. He measured distances upon the map with the air of a student, while his companions stamped and fumed and cursed like a corporal of hussars. It was strange to see the old man so fiery and the young one so reserved. I could not understand all that they said, but I was very sure about their general meaning.
"I tell you, we must push on and ever on," cried the old fellow with a furious German oath. "I promised Wellington that I would be there with the whole army, even if I had to be strapped to my horse. Bulow's corps is in action, and Zieten shall support it with every man and gun. Forward, Gneisenau, forward!"
The other shook his head. "You must remember, Your Excellency, that if the English are beaten, they will make for the coast. What will your position be then, with Grouchy between you and the Rhine?"
"We shall beat them, Gneisenau. The Duke and I will grind them to powder between us. Push on, I say. The whole war will be ended in one blow. Bring Pirsch up, and we can throw 60,000 men into the scale while Thielmann holds Grouchy beyond Wavre."
Gneisenau shrugged his shoulders, but at that instant an orderly appeared at the door. "An aide-de-camp from the Duke of Wellington," said he.
"Ha-ha!" cried the old man. "Let us hear what he has to say."
An English officer, with mud and blood all over his scarlet jacket, staggered into the room. A crimson-stained handkerchief was knotted round his arm, and he held the table to keep himself from falling. "My message is to Marshal Blucher," said he.
"I am Marshal Blucher."
"Go on, go on," cried the impatient old man. "The Duke bade me to tell you, sir, that the British army can hold its own, and that he has no fears for the result. The French cavalry has been destroyed. Two of their divisions of infantry have ceased to exist, and only the guard is in reserve. If you give us a vigorous support, the defeat will be changed to absolute rout, and—" His knees gave way under him, and he fell in a heap upon the floor.
"Enough, enough!" cried Blucher. "Nicer now, send an aide-de-camp to Wellington, and tell him to rely upon me to the full. Come on, gentlemen, we have our work to do."
He bustled eagerly out of the room, with all his staff clanking behind him, while two orderlies carried the English messenger to the care of the surgeon. Gneisenau, the chief of staff, had lingered behind for an instant, and he laid his hand upon one of the aides-de-camp. The fellow had attracted my attention, for I have always a quick eye for a fine man. He was tall and slender, the very model of a horseman. Indeed, there was something in his appearance which made it not unlike my own. His face was dark and as keen as that of a hawk, with fierce black eyes under thick, shaggy brows, and a moustache which would have put him in the crack squadron of my hussars. He wore a green coat with white facings and a horsehair helmet, a dragoon, as I conjectured, and as dashing a cavalier as one would wish to have at the end of one's sword-point. "A word with you, Count Stein," said Gneisenau. "If the enemy are routed, but if the Emperor escapes, he will rally another army, and all will have to be done again. But if we can get the Emperor, then the war is indeed ended. It is worth a great effort, and a great risk for such an object as that." The young dragoon said nothing, but he listened attentively. "Suppose the Duke of Wellington's words should prove to be correct, and the French army should be driven in utter rout from the field. The Emperor will certainly take the road back through Genappe and Charleroi as being the shortest to the frontier. We can imagine that his horses will be fleet, and that the fugitives will make way for him. Our cavalry will follow the rear of the beaten army, but the Emperor will be far away at the front of the throng." The young dragoon inclined his head. "To you, Count Stein, I commit the Emperor. If you take him, your name will live in history. You have the reputation of being the hardest rider in our army. Do you choose such comrades as you may select. 10 or a dozen should be enough. You are not to engage in the battle, nor are you to follow the general pursuit, but you are to ride clear of the crowd, reserving your energies for a nobler end. Do you understand me?" Again the dragoon inclined his head. This silence impressed me. I felt that he was indeed a dangerous man. "Then I leave the details in your own hands. Strike at no one except the highest. You cannot mistake the imperial carriage, nor can you fail to recognize the figure of the Emperor. Now I must follow the Marshal. Adieu. If ever I see you again, I trust that it will be to congratulate you upon a deed which will ring through Europe." The dragoon saluted, and Gneisenau hurried from the room. The young officer stood in deep thought for a few moments. Then he followed the chief of staff. I looked with curiosity from my loophole to see what his next proceeding would be. His horse, a fine, strong chestnut with two white stockings, was fastened to the rail of the inn. He sprang into the saddle, and riding to intercept a column of cavalry which was passing, he spoke to an officer at the head of the leading regiment. Presently, after some talk, I saw two hussars, it was a hussar regiment, drop out of the ranks and take up their position beside Count Stein. The next regiment was also stopped, and two lancers were added to his escort. The next furnished him with two dragoons, and the next with two cuirassiers. Then he drew his little group of horsemen aside, and he gathered them round him, explaining to them what they had to do. Finally, the nine soldiers rode off together and disappeared into the wood of Paris. I need not tell you, my friends, what all this portended. Indeed, he had acted exactly as I should have done in his place. From each colonel he had demanded the two best horsemen in the regiment, and so he had assembled a band who might expect to catch whatever they should follow. Heaven help the Emperor if, without an escort, he should find them on his track. And I, dear friends, imagine the fever, the ferment, the madness of my mind. All thought of Grouchy had passed away. No guns were to be heard to the east. He could not be near. If he should come up, he would not now be in time to alter the event of the day. The sun was already low in the sky, and there could not be more than 2 or 3 hours of daylight. My mission might be dismissed as useless, but here was another mission, more pressing, more immediate, a mission which meant the safety, and perhaps the life of the Emperor. At all costs, through every danger, I must get back to his side. But how was I to do it? The whole Prussian army was now between me and the French lines. They blocked every road, but they could not block the path of duty when Etienne Gerard sees it lie before him. I could not wait longer. I must be gone. There was but the one opening to the loft, and so it was only down the ladder that I could descend. I looked into the kitchen, and I found that the young surgeon was still there. In a chair sat the wounded English aide-de-camp, and on the straw lay 2 Prussian soldiers in the last stage of exhaustion. The others had all recovered and been sent on. These were my enemies, and I must pass through them in order to gain my horse. From the surgeon I had nothing to fear. The Englishman was wounded, and his sword stood with his cloak in a corner. The 2 Germans were half insensible, and their muskets were not beside them. What could be simpler? I opened the trap-door, slipped down the ladder, and appeared in the midst of them, my sword drawn in my hand. What a picture of surprise! The surgeon, of course, knew all, but to the Englishman and the 2 Germans it must have seemed that the god of war in person had descended from the skies. With my appearance, with my figure, with my silver and grey uniform, and with that gleaming sword in my hand, I must indeed have been a sight worth seeing. The 2 Germans lay petrified with staring eyes. The English officer half rose, but sat down again from weakness, his mouth open and his hand on the back of his chair. "What the deuce?" he kept on repeating. "What the deuce?" "Pray, do not move," said I. "I will hurt no one, but woe to the man who lays hands upon me to stop me. You have nothing to fear if you leave me alone, and nothing to hope if you try to hinder me. I am Colonel Etienne Gerard of the Hussars of Conflans." "The deuce," said the Englishman. "You are the man that killed the fox." A terrible scowl had darkened his face. The jealousy of sportsmen is a base passion. He hated me, this Englishman, because I had been before him in transfixing the animal. How different are our natures! Had I seen him do such a deed, I would have embraced him with cries of joy. But there was no time for argument. "I regret it, sir," said I, "but you have a cloak here, and I must take it." He tried to rise from his chair and reach his sword, but I got between him and the corner where it lay. "If there is anything in the pockets?" "A case," said he. "I would not rob you," said I, and raising the cloak, I took from the pockets a silver flask, a square wooden case, and a field glass. All these I handed to him. The wretch opened the case, took out a pistol, and pointed it straight at my head. "Now, my fine fellow," said he, "put down your sword and give yourself up." I was so astounded at this infamous action that I stood petrified before him. I tried to speak to him of honour and gratitude, but I saw his eyes fix and harden over the pistol. "Enough talk," said he. "Drop it." Could I endure such a humiliation? Death were better than to be disarmed in such a fashion. The word "fire" was on my lips, when in an instant the Englishman vanished from before my face, and in his place was a great pile of hay, with a red-coated arm and 2 Hessian boots waving and kicking in the heart of it. Oh, the gallant landlady! It was my whiskers that had saved me. "Fly, soldier, fly!" she cried, and she heaped fresh trusses of hay from the floor onto the struggling Englishman. In an instant I was out in the courtyard, had led Violette from her stable, and was on her back. A pistol bullet whizzed past my shoulder from the window, and I saw a furious face looking out at me. I smiled my contempt and spurred out into the road. The last of the Prussians had passed, and both my road and my duty lay clear before me. If France won, all well. If France lost, then on me and my little mare depended that which was more than victory or defeat, the safety and the life of the Emperor. "On, Etienne, on!" I cried. "Of all your noble exploits, the greatest, even if it be the last, lies now before you." End of section 19, and end of the story of the Forest Inn.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.